Chapter 80, The 30 Years' War. A confused noise. Angry exclamations and cries resound. Angrily a window is pushed open. A voice, trembling with suppressed rage, cries out, "Throw them out of the window." Loud cries of approval resound. A brief, violent struggle. Then a head appears through the open window, arms, legs. Then a body plunges down from the third story. A moment later, a second one follows. Grim faces look through the window down at the falling bodies. Two men are roughly pushed downward. They shall be smashed in the depth. No wonder that the faces of the victims are distorted through mortal fear which gleams from their eyes. Their bodies shall land with a hard thud upon the ground and perhaps burst open. No, not so after all. A loud splash, and they get a ducking in the moat which surrounds the castle. Sometime later, while sneezing and blowing, they come to the surface, splash to the side, and disappear as soon as possible. Their fall into the water saved their life. According to other writers, they did not land into the castle moat, but upon a dunghill which broke their mortal fall. However it may be, they escaped with their life and hastened away from this ill-fated place. No doubt you shall ask wonderingly, what is the meaning of all this? Who are these men? Why are they hurled down out of the window? Yes, that is a sad story. This event transports us mentally to Prague, the capital of Bohemia. We have heard something about that place before, did we not? Bohemia, that is the country where John Huss preached at one time. It is the country where the bloody Hussite War raged for years. We told you about that in Chapter 60. You have not forgotten those stories, have you? Well, then, again, it is not going very well in Bohemia. In the year 1618, a dangerous revolt breaks out in Prague. It is the same story again. Rome is raging once more in Bohemia to exterminate, if possible, with root and branch, the Protestant religion in Bohemia. There are still thousands and ten thousands of Protestants in Bohemia who desire nothing else than freedom of religion. No, they were no criminals or insurgents. They were decent, industrious people who molested no one. The only thing which they desired was that they could calmly and undisturbed read God's word, and that they could go to their houses of worship without being hampered. In 1609, Rudolf II ruled over Germany and Bohemia. He gave an imperial letter to the Bohemians, in which was written that the Bohemians received freedom of religion, and that they were permitted to build churches in which they could assemble to listen to the preaching of God's word. This letter is known in history as the Magistratsbrief. Not that this emperor thought so much of the Protestants, because he was a pupil of the Jesuits, but he had done that for other reasons. How pleased the Bohemians were! That was just what they desired. They did not ask for more. But their joy did not last long. Not long after that, Emperor Rudolf II died. Under his successor, Emperor Matthias, the misery commenced again. This new emperor did not concern himself very much about that Magistratsbrief. A new church, which had just been built by the Bohemian Protestants, was demolished to the ground by the imperial soldiers. Other church buildings, which had been used weekly by them, were closed at his command. And thus it went on, every time that Magistrat's brief was violated. Complaints to the emperor were of no avail, because Matthias would not even listen to them. It is therefore easily understood that the Bohemians became angry. They were provoked to the limit. And really, why? How sky high is the guilt of Rome. It came to an eruption in 1618. Two imperial governors in Prague were hurled out of the window, which we just told you about. That was the signal, and now the rebellion burst loose in all its violence. In the beginning, the Bohemians were very successful. They advanced victoriously and even threatened Vienna, the capital of Austria. With this rebellion, one of the bloodiest wars commenced which was ever fought. That war would last 30 years, by which not only Bohemia, but also a large portion of Germany would be laid waste. It is 2 years later, thus in 1620, upon the White Mountain in the neighborhood of the Bohemian capital Prague, a battle is raging. The cries of the combatants and the groaning of the wounded fills the air. It is just Sunday, but the quiet Sunday calm is roughly disturbed by the turmoil of the battle. The Bohemian army and the imperial soldiers are fighting each other for life and death. War has broken out in full violence. Emperor Matthias had died after a brief reign, and his successor, Emperor Ferdinand II, ascended the throne. This emperor was a zealous Roman Catholic, and besides, he was instigated by the crafty, fanatical Jesuits. The Bohemians said, "We will not acknowledge Emperor Ferdinand as our ruler," and they chose another king. At that time, Frederick V ruled over the Palatinate, the electorate on the Rhine about whom we already spoke in the previous chapter. He was married to a daughter of Prince William of Orange, and hence a brother-in-law of Maurice, who at that time was governor of the Netherlands. Well then, this Frederick V was chosen as king by the Bohemian people in the year 1619. Alas, this king was no good commander. The imperial army of Ferdinand II did have an excellent commander, General Tilly. Those two armies collided with each other in 1620 on the White Mountain outside of Prague. The battle lasted only a short time. In 1 hour, Frederick V was defeated, and the Bohemians fled in disorder. The king himself scarcely escaped death. He fled to the Netherlands and received permission from Maurice that he could live there. Because he had ruled only 1 year over Bohemia, his enemies mockingly called him the Winter King. The people of Bohemia have suffered terribly. The Bohemian nobles were compelled to become Roman Catholic, and if they would not do that, then their possessions were confiscated and given to German nobles. The common people were cruelly oppressed by the rapacious and cruel soldiers of Tilly. The revolt in Bohemia had been struck down with bloodshed. The Roman Catholic soldiers acted with a cruelty which had no respect for anything. Just to show you what happened there, we shall mention one thing. Some victims were nailed fast with their tongue to the scaffold. It cannot be described what those poor people had to suffer and endure. We shall say no more about those cruelties. It is known to the righteous judge of heaven and earth. The Bohemian people were struck with terror. While leaving everything behind, thousands fled to safer districts. Altogether, at least 30,000 families left the country. The Netherlands also had compassion on various poor, indigent, and dislodged refugees. They were permitted to settle there, and they were charitably treated. The Protestant church in Bohemia was almost totally exterminated and destroyed. It cannot be described what has been suffered there, but one day all that innocent shed blood shall be required at the hand of the Roman Catholic Church. When Tilly, the commander of the imperial forces, was finished with his abominable work in Bohemia, he marched with his robbing and marauding soldiers to the Palatinate and invaded that electorate. They fought fiercely there, but Tilly gained the victory and the Palatinate was likewise laid waste and looted. Triumphantly, the Roman Catholic armies marched to the north. The German Emperor Ferdinand II was not satisfied with the annihilation of Protestantism in Bohemia. No, also the Protestant Church in Germany had to be annihilated. Entire Germany had to become Roman Catholic again. The Reformation had to be exterminated with root and branch. Especially the Jesuits, about whom we told you in chapter 78, were the cause of that. They were the terrible advisors of Frederick II. But how about the other Protestant electors in Germany? Did they tolerate all that calmly? Why did they not conclude an alliance so that together they could combat the imperial armies? Why did they not assist the pathetic Bohemians and the electorate of the Palatinate? They were their brothers, were they not? Ah, those Protestant electorates had quarrels and disagreements among each other. If they had joined ranks and had marched together, then they could have saved Protestantism in Bohemia and Germany. But they did not do that. Shame. Their attitude was profoundly pitiful. Self-interest and jealousy dominated their actions. Their guilt is also sky-high, because through their negligence, they were co-responsible for the horrors which were committed. They could have prevented that. We shall hear more about that. That which the German electors neglected to do to their own shame and harm, Christian IV, King of Denmark, attempted to do. This monarch, with his subjects, professed the Lutheran religion. With concern in the heart, he saw that the Roman Catholic armies in Germany were so successful. He decided to come to the aid of his German co-religionists. He invaded Germany with his troops, but he was defeated by Tilly and had to flee. He quickly made peace and received everything back which had already been conquered by Tilly, but he must promise that henceforth he would not meddle with Germany again. Protestantism in Germany stood upon the brink of ruin. Shall then the work of God in Germany perish in an ocean of misery and blood? Shall then the Prince of Darkness be victorious after all? Who? Who shall rescue God's church in Germany? Be silent. Listen. A mighty fortress is our God. How nice that sounds. Who are singing that? Just come with us, we see it already. Off the northern coast of Germany, in the Baltic Sea, a fleet is anchored, being manned by sailors and soldiers. The soldiers disembark and go on shore. There are a great many of them, thousands of men, It is an entire army, also cannons and other weapons, yea, everything which belongs to the equipment of an army is put on shore. Behold, finally the army, 13,000 men strong, stands on German soil. The king, clothed in an iron coat of mail, kneels down upon the shore and thanks God for the safe arrival. Then the army marches further into the country, heading for the war, yea, perhaps for death. Who is that king? Who are those soldiers? Where do they come from? Where are they going? What is the object of their expedition? These are all questions which must be answered. That king is Gustavus Adolphus, the God-fearing monarch of Sweden. His name may never be forgotten because this hero has read the scripture word, "Bear ye one another's burdens," and he understood that too. Sweden. That country, just as Denmark, had also shaken off the Roman Catholic yoke. Brave men had already traveled to the north, who had preached the gospel in Sweden. They met with violent opposition from the Roman Catholic clergy, and also the people remained in the beginning faithful to the Roman Catholic Church. This changed when in 1523, Gustavus Vasa was proclaimed as king. He called a diet together, and at that diet it was decided that the gospel could be freely preached in Sweden. This has been the means that eventually the Reformation obtained the upper hand also in that country. Much could be told about that, but this is briefly the history of the coming and establishing of the Reformation in Sweden. Well then, in those dark days, Gustavus Adolphus ruled over Sweden. He was a brave and God-fearing monarch. Now he stands upon German soil. He left his beloved native country with 13,000 brave soldiers who loved and honored their king. He comes to the aid of his threatened with destruction co-religionists in Germany. He shall support and assist the Protestants in their embittered struggle against the Roman Catholic violence. Oh, his heart bled when he heard how Rome raged in Germany. Profound compassion filled his soul when he learned about the atrocities which the Roman Catholic soldiers committed in Bohemia and the Palatinate. The indescribable sufferings of the inhabitants of Bohemia and the Palatinate caused his heart to cringe with grief. More than once already, he had seriously considered to hasten to the assistance of his oppressed co-religionists in Germany. But yea, to cross over to Germany with an entire army was not so easy. That would cost large sums of money, more money than Sweden could pay. And lo, suddenly help comes. That help came from a direction where no one would have expected it. Catholic France offers Gustavus Adolphus a large sum of money if he will join in battle in Germany against the German Emperor Ferdinand II. You may probably ask, how is that possible? Is France going to help the Protestants against Rome? We would have thought that France would just have helped the German Emperor to destroy German Protestantism. However, that does not happen. On the contrary. Why then does France do that? Well, that is very simple. Because France is afraid that the German Emperor shall become too powerful, and that could become very dangerous for France. Those two nations have always been mortal enemies of each other, and that secret fear is the reason that France shall support Sweden if that country shall cast itself into the struggle in Germany. Gustavus Adolphus accepts that monetary support because with that he can hasten to the aid of his brothers in Germany. The Swedish monarch only had to promise France that he would not persecute the Roman Catholic subjects in Germany. Well then, the Swedish king could easily make that promise, because that was not his intention anyway. He departs from Sweden with an excellently provided and equipped army, and in 1630 he lands on German soil. Each regiment has its own army chaplain. Order and discipline prevail in the Swedish army, and the Swedish soldiers do not make themselves guilty of murder and plundering. Gustavus Adolphus would not tolerate that. How glad the Protestant electors must be that someone has come to support them in the bitter struggle against the Roman Catholic Emperor Ferdinand II. Yea, you would think that, isn't that so? But you are mistaken. The electors of Pomerania, Brandenburg, and Saxony are not pleased at all with the coming of Gustavus Adolphus. Instead of vigorously supporting him, they do nothing at all. Yea, worse, they secretly oppose him. Close to the place where the Swedish army has landed, the Pomeranian capital Stettin is situated. But that city will not open its gates for the Swedish army. What a disappointment that must have been for the noble Gustavus Adolphus. Is that now the gratitude for his sacrifice? Yet the Swedish king does not become discouraged. Oh no, he knows what he wants. If it cannot be done willingly, then unwillingly. When the government officials from Stettin come to him in the camp to bring him the message that he must move further on, he answers them while pointing at his guns, "These are the keys of the city." With that he means, "If you will not open the gates voluntarily, then I shall shoot them open with my guns." And yea, that forceful answer really makes an impression. Stettin opens the gates because they dare not risk that. Calmly, the Swedish army enters Stettin. In this way, the elector of Pomerania is compelled to support him. The elector of Brandenburg is also put in his place by Gustavus Adolphus. They are supposed to be his allies. In a word, pitiful. It is self-evident that the German Emperor Ferdinand II also hears that Gustavus Adolphus has landed with an army in Germany. But he laughs about that. His courtiers say mockingly to each other, "Just let that snow majesty come south once, then he shall melt." However, they won't mock very long, because they are mistaken. In the meantime, the imperial army under command of Tilly and a cavalry general Pappenheim march through Germany, plundering and murdering, and Schleswig-Holstein, an electorate in the north of Germany and Jutland, are devastated. After that, Tilly and his army march to the south again and lay siege to the city of Magdeburg. This was a Protestant city, and the inhabitants defended themselves desperately and with great valor. They hoped and expected that Gustavus Adolphus would relieve them and drive Tilly away from before the walls. The Swedish monarch desired to hasten to the assistance of the besieged city, but then he had to march through the electorate of Saxony, and the elector of Saxony refused him passage. Is it not enough to become discouraged under all this? And that is now a Protestant elector. How is it possible? In that way, Gustavus Adolphus cannot get to the besieged city. Tilly, who is afraid that Gustavus Adolphus may still come suddenly with his army, has the city of Magdeburg bombarded. He succeeds in conquering the city. On the 20th of May, 1631, the imperial troops march into Magdeburg. The army of Tilly has made terrible havoc in that distressful city. More than 30,000 people were murdered, and only a smoking heap of rubble was left of that prosperous city. That was the fault of two Protestant electors. Is this not very, very grievous? They are also guilty of the thousandfold murders in Magdeburg. Protestant merchants from the Protestant city of Hamburg sold food and weapons, powder and bullets to the imperial troops that were encamped before Magdeburg to earn a few pennies by that. It is really no wonder that Protestantism almost perished in Germany. In that way, it can be no different. God has kept his church standing in Germany, and he used the Swedish king Gustavus Adolphus for that purpose. For 5 days, the Roman Catholic troops have plundered, massacred, and burned Magdeburg. Do you know what the Pope in Rome wrote when he heard of that massacre? No? Then we shall tell you. Do not frighten. The smoking heaps of rubble of that sinful city shall be the eternal memorials of God's mercy. For something like that, there are no longer words. After the fall of Magdeburg, Tilly invades Saxony and conquers the capital city of Leipzig. And yea, now the Elector of Saxony begs Gustavus Adolphus to help him. At first, the Swedish king was not allowed to march through his territory to hasten to the assistance of pathetic Magdeburg. But now that the Elector of Saxony himself gets into difficulty, now that his own country shall be devastated and the people massacred, yea, now Gustavus Adolphus must come to help him. He did not deserve that assistance, but happily for him, the God-fearing king of Sweden did not take revenge. Immediately he and his brave soldiers marches into the electorate of Saxony and encamps in the little city of Wittenberg, where Luther for so many years has labored so blessedly. There the Reformation had commenced. The two hostile armies are now lying close to each other. The Saxon army joins itself to the Swedish army. Soon the Roman Catholic and Protestant troops shall join battle. Tilly hankers after settling accounts with that snow king. But the Swedish forces also want to avenge the massacre of Magdeburg. Who shall win? Who shall lose? So much depends upon that approaching battle. It is September 17, 1631. Near the town of Breitenfeld, close to Leipzig, both armies have entrenched themselves and are preparing themselves for the conflict. It is still very early in the morning. The imperial soldiers awake and get everything ready for the struggle, which shall break out this day. They do not fear. Why should they fear? Is not the brave, invincible Tilly their commander? Their brave general has never been defeated. He has always gained the victory in 36 battles and numberless smaller encounters. Tilly, the brave but cruel 70-year-old commander of the Roman Catholic soldiers, was born in Belgium, in the city of Liege. He spent a few of his youthful years in a Jesuit monastery. The Duke of Parma had taught him the waging of war. He had developed himself into an excellent general. It is a pity that he stood on the wrong side and that he waged war with unprecedented cruelty. Germany had experienced that. For that reason, his soldiers are firmly convinced that in the evening of that day they shall have gained the victory. Ranting and cursing, they finally advance while heading for the victory. At least, that is what they think. The Swedish army also awakens in that early morning hour. Quietly and calmly, everyone prepares himself. A serious expression is upon many faces. They know, this day death shall drag in a rich harvest. Perhaps they will be included therein. Shall they never see their beloved country again? Shall they ever return to the home from which they departed? And when finally they are also ready for the bloody conflict, the beautiful reformer's hymn, "A Mighty Fortress," is heard from thousands of mouths. Gustavus Adolphus draws near to his army, which stands ready. He uncovers his head before the troops and prays to God for aid and assistance in the heavy conflict which is at hand. Humbly he implores the Lord for the victory, so that his name shall be honored and extolled. He knows that the conflict shall be difficult. He knows that he has the invincible Tilly over against him. Yet he does not fear the conflict, because his hope is fixed upon God. Then the battle commences. The roaring of the cannons drowns out everything. The struggle is terrible. By hundreds, by thousands, the young warriors fall down. The Saxon army, which had joined itself to the Swedish army to defend their country, becomes confused and flees. The Saxons suffer heavy losses. But the Swedish army does not flee. Immovably, the Swedes stand firm. The conflict rages till late in the afternoon. But then the imperial army takes to flight. Tilly, their commander, who sees the unbelievable happen, pleads and prays, curses in impotent rage at the fleeing soldiers. But whatever he does, it is of no avail. They cannot be held back. Against his will, he is dragged along in the complete rout. The Roman Catholic army suffered heavy losses. 9,000 soldiers, who in the morning boasted so much about the victory, are killed. Their corpses cover the battlefield. The Swedes have taken 9,000 prisoners. The remainder of the imperial army is completely scattered and dispersed. That day, the so-called invincible Tilly is crushingly defeated. God has answered the prayer of the Swedish monarch and has given deliverance. The cheering of the Swedes is heard in the far distance. The Swedish army lost only 700 men. Compared with the imperial troops, that was very little. The losses of the Saxon army were greater. Gustavus Adolphus reverently uncovers the head and thanks God for the glorious victory. Swiftly, the Swedish monarch marches further. Soon, entire Saxony has been liberated from the murdering hordes of the Roman Catholics. Tilly gathers the remnants of his defeated army. He shall still try to defend the Roman Catholic electorate of Bavaria against the victorious advancing army of the Swedes. In one of those battles, the gray-haired man is mortally wounded, and within a few days he dies of the wounds which he had received. God has spoken. Hitherto his career was at an end. And how? Gustavus Adolphus marches into Bavaria. City after city falls into his hands. The Roman Catholic capital, Munich, trembles when Gustavus Adolphus appears before the gates. Shall the Swedish king take revenge because of the horrible massacre of Magdeburg? Shall the corpses of thousands and ten thousands of Roman Catholic men, women, and children now cover the streets? No, not really. The victor takes no bloody revenge. The Roman Catholic murderers can take an example from that. However, the Swedish soldiers do discover 140 nice, bright new cannons which the Roman Catholics have buried. Naturally, they are taken. That was their honest war booty, a substantial sum of money. Cunningly smuggled away in the mouths of the cannons, is likewise declared as booty. But no person has any harm done to him, or is molested. Now the courtiers of Emperor Ferdinand II no longer mock the Snow Majesty. He seems to be well able to stand the warm south, and does not melt. Terror filled the heart of the emperor. Tilly, his best general, has been killed. What must be done now? Who shall check the victorious Swedish monarch? The tables are turned. He still has one who can lead his troops, but he would rather not take him. The name of that man is Wallenstein. This commander had fought with them before. He waged war in his own way. The emperor need not make money available for his army. Wallenstein himself took care that they received their wages. And do you know how he took care of that? Wherever they passed by, he permitted his soldiers to rob and to plunder as much as they wanted. That was their wages. Poor inhabitants, wherever Wallenstein's army marched by. Villages and cities changed into smoking heaps of rubble. Everything which had any value and which could be taken along was robbed. The people were maltreated and murdered, and the houses were burned. In this way he left his soldiers pay themselves. Well then, in his great need, the emperor placed Wallenstein at the head of his troops. He was forced to, because he had no other capable commander. The reason why the emperor would rather not use Wallenstein was because Wallenstein was so proud and ambitious of power. In the meantime, Gustavus Adolphus had conquered almost all of Bavaria. Wherever the Swedish hero marched, he was loudly applauded by the grateful people. In him they saw their deliverer. Some even fell upon their knees before him and kissed the hem of his garment. This veneration went too far. The humble monarch shook his head and spoke seriously. I fear that God shall punish this idolatrous veneration. More than a year after the glorious victory of Gustavus Adolphus upon Tilly, at Breitenfeld, the two hostile armies stand over against each other again at Lützen. This place is located a few hours' walking distance from Leipzig, hence in Saxony. Wallenstein had invaded Saxony with his army, and in that way wants to compel Gustavus Adolphus to stop his triumphant march. The Swedish king scarcely hears that, or he goes after his enemy. Early in the morning, a heavy fog hangs over the fields, so that nothing can be done. But scarcely has the fog lifted, or the battle commences. Again, Gustavus Adolphus beseeches the Lord for his blessing upon the severe struggle which is at hand. He addresses his brave soldiers for the last time. Then the cannons roar, and great clouds of gunpowder smoke float over the battlefield. With impetuous valor, the Swedes press on, and the army of Wallenstein yields. At that decisive moment, the cavalry General Pappenheim appears upon the battlefield with 1,500 horsemen. Unexpectedly, he attacks the Swedes, and these fall back. Gustavus Adolphus notices that. He hastens to the threatened point to encourage his soldiers and to bring them to a halt. During that ride, he is wounded in the arm, and besides, he is shot in the back. A moment later, he is recognized by several cavalrymen of Pappenheim, and they shoot him dead. What a terrible blow for Protestantism! The horse of the king runs riderless over the battlefield. Soon the sad tidings is heard throughout the army that their beloved king has been killed. The Swedes decide to avenge the death of their beloved king. Embittered, they attack again, and the imperial armies are forced back and flee. The victory is won, but at a great price. Pappenheim, the cavalry general, is also mortally wounded and dies from his many wounds. But that does not alter the fact that the loss of Gustavus Adolphus is great. We would say, why all this? But the Lord gives no account of his deeds, and he is a jealous God for his honor. The next day the Swedes find the corpse of their king among a pile of other corpses, mutilated and robbed. His mortal remains are carried to Sweden, and there he is buried in Stockholm. There the great hero rests till the last day. Then he shall arise and extol God forever. The young monarch was only 38 years old when on November 6, 1632, he breathed his last upon the bloody battlefield of Lützen. Dejection prevailed among Protestants not only in Germany, but entire Protestant Europe sympathized. However, in the Roman Catholic circles they rejoiced. The last words of the cavalry General Pappenheim, who, as we already wrote, had also succumbed to his wounds, were, "I die with joy, now that I know that he also is dead." However, Rome rejoiced too soon, because the labor of Gustavus Adolphus had not been in vain. As a means in God's hand, he has saved Protestantism in Germany from a certain apparent ruin. After his death, the war raged for another 16 years. Much could be told about this, but we must finish this chapter, otherwise it would become far too long. For that reason, with respect to the rest, we shall be brief. The war was carried on with alternating success for many years. In 1634, thus 2 years after the death of Gustavus Adolphus, Wallenstein was murdered, perhaps upon a secret command of Emperor Ferdinand II. In 1635, France plunged itself into the war, now not only with monetary support such as that nation had done for Gustavus Adolphus, but actually, that means with troops. Now French soldiers themselves fought along on the German battlefields. Germany has suffered terribly during those last years. Foreign troops from almost all countries in Europe overran Germany. Divisions and discord among the Protestant electors made it still worse and aggravated the misery of the poor German people. The electorate of Saxony committed treason and fought on the Roman Catholic side against the Swedish forces. Indeed, was this the thanks that Gustavus Adolphus had saved that country out of the hand of the ruthless Tilly? The embittered Swedish soldiers invaded Saxony and destroyed entire regions. Thus we could go on. At one time the Swedes were on the winning side. Then again they belonged to the losing party. Bloody battles were fought, every one of which we will not mention. Indeed, that is not necessary. It concerns the principal things. Thus, the years of the war dragged on. At length, all parties became tired of fighting. Finally, in 1648, the so well-known Peace of Westphalia was concluded. This peace not only put an end to the 30 years' war in Germany, but at the same time to the 80 years' war in the Netherlands. Great was the joy in Germany, yea, in almost all countries of Europe. Magnificent festivals were celebrated everywhere. It would have been better if they had omitted those feasts, because the sacrifices had been too bloody for that. The consequences have been terrible for Germany. Cities and villages were destroyed. Yea, entire regions had been transferred into a wilderness. Entire provinces were ravaged by famine. Even after the conclusion of peace, the pestilence still dragged thousands to the grave. The people had become brutalized because of the indescribable misery which they had endured. Half of Germany's population had perished in this horrible war. They estimate the number of dead to be about 8 million. Some regions lost many more than half of the number of residents. Before the 30 Years' War, the well-known city of Augsburg numbered 90,000 inhabitants. After the war, there were only 6,000 people left. All the others had perished in that dreadful struggle. In the Palatinate, only a fifth part of the population was still alive. Thus, we could mention still more. The large, prosperous German Empire was impoverished, trampled, and beaten down. It was no longer numbered among the nations. It would take years before it would be somewhat recovered again from the bloody wounds which had been inflicted. The Protestant electors themselves were for the greatest part the guilty ones of all that misery. Through their quarrels among them and jealousies, through their betrayal of the good cause, they had often brought Protestantism to the brink of ruin. It would have never become so bad if they had been united in their struggle against Rome. But in spite of all that, God has performed his counsel. The reign of God continues. The bloody sacrifices have not been made in vain. At the Peace of Westphalia, the Protestants obtained complete liberty of religion. Not only the Lutherans, but also the Reformed, that means the followers of Calvin, obtained this liberty. The aspiration of the Jesuits to carry through by brute force the Counter-Reformation in Germany and to quench the light of the Reformation had failed. That had been their aim. But that aim had to fail because the eternal King of his church rules. And although it was through an ocean of blood and tears, yet God's church has triumphed. We also see in this the war between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. But thanks be to God, his church stands firm to all eternity.